Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for tuning in today. Hello, everybody. The White House has now officially released the 16-page white paper on drones that someone leaked to NBC News earlier this week. The release comes as you heard on the news, President Obama's CIA director nominee John Brennan will testify today at his confirmation hearing, a rare chance for elected officials to get information about drone strikes and allegations of torture on the record. Brennan has been President Obama's top counterterrorism official and held a related position in the Bush administration, where he was reportedly in the loop on waterboarding and other controversial interrogation techniques. We'll talk about the issues involved now with two human rights advocates, Zeke Johnson, director of Amnesty International's USA Security with Human Rights Campaign, and Omar Shakir, a law student involved with the International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic at Stanford Law School and co-author of a widely discussed report last year called Living Under Drones. Zeke and Omar, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having us.
Omar, your report refers to, quote, the disastrous impact the drone strikes are having on people who live under them. Can you describe the disastrous impact as you see it?
Absolutely. I think when we first started the research project, we hoped to answer the question of whether or not drones were, as they've been depicted, a surgically precise weapons that only kill terrorists and nobody else. And certainly, in the course of doing our research over the course of a year with NYU and with a team of faculty and students, we certainly came across significant evidence that drones do kill and maim civilians. But I think what really surprised us the most was the effect that drones have on everyday life. In some parts of North Waziristan, the area in which the drone campaign is really focused in Pakistan, drones, you know, fly overhead in some cases 24 hours a day, in some cases four or five at a time. And the people we spoke with who live under drones, including victims of drone strikes or those that have lost family members in strikes, told us about how harrowing that experience is of living under drones and the way in which it affects everyday life, the kind of fear and terror they experience every day, going to school, going to work, going about their business, and the way in which it has affected activities from, you know, traditional community gatherings to school attendance, to willingness to rescue those that might be injured in a strike, to attendance at funerals, to even basic things like the willingness to attend a wedding or to, you know, go out with friends on a weeknight evening. So I think what really was devastating to us was the extent to which everyday life and basic social institutions had been fundamentally altered as a result of the presence of drones overhead.
This idea of drones being overhead 24 hours a day, I don't know how, you know, independently how often they or for how long they fly, but it is supposed to be, from the U.S. military standpoint, one of the benefits of drones, that they're both surveillance vehicles and attack vehicles. So they can watch, they can monitor who they think the targets are until they're ready to strike, and then strike from the same aircraft. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's been the argument that's been put forward by the administration, although certainly the evidence that we have seen to date of drones suggests that they may not be as effective as they've been marketed out to be. I mean, in our study, for example, we document how only, according to a White House study itself, only about 2% of those that have actually been killed were high-level members of armed non-state actors. And our report also goes through some of the intelligence that's relied upon. And let's not forget that we're using, in some cases, worse intelligence than was used to detain folks in Guantanamo Bay. And as we know today, over 90% of those that were detained in Guantanamo Bay were actually never charged with a crime, and many of whom were found not to be involved at all in acts of terrorism. So I think, you know, that has certainly been the rationale that's been put forward. But I think if we analyze strategically, even ignoring the legal implications or the humanitarian consequences, there are reasons to doubt whether or not drones have been effective and whether or not they actually are facilitating recruitment to the very groups we're aiming to go after.
Listeners, if you want to call in with a question or comment, about drones and some of the things that are coming out this week from the White House. You can at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. On any side of this, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And by the way, we've got some very interesting reading material on our website if you want to look at some of this drone-related stuff, including the white paper on killing U.S. civilians that was just released last night at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Zeke from Amnesty, let me bring you in on that point. This policy white paper now officially released by the administration after being leaked earlier in the week gets pretty specific about criteria for approving drone strikes, at least on U.S. citizens abroad, specifically U.S. citizens. As NBC's Mike Isikoff sums it up, the targets must be senior operational leaders of al-Qaeda or an associated force, an imminent threat, their capture must be infeasible, and the strikes must be carried out according to accepted principles under the law of war. Is all that acceptable to you?
Thanks so much, Brian. I mean, what's astonishing to me about this new white paper, in quotes, is that there's no mention whatsoever of international human rights law. The big picture here is that the Obama administration is using the quote-unquote global war legal theory carried over from the Bush administration to basically claim that the world is a battlefield and only the law of armed conflict applies, not human rights law. Amnesty International is deeply concerned that the Obama administration's policy on the use of lethal force appears to permit extrajudicial executions in violation of human rights law virtually anywhere in the world.
But is that overbroad? Let me play you a clip of President Obama himself describing his drone policy. This comes from a Google Hangout interview last year.
I think that there's this perception somehow that we're just sending in a whole bunch of strikes willy-nilly. This is a targeted, focused effort at people who are on a list of active terrorists who are trying to go in and harm Americans, hit American facilities, American bases, and so on. It is important for everybody to understand that this thing is kept on a very tight leash.
A very tight leash. And here's another clip of the president. He doesn't make many comments about drones. This is one of the reasons that the Brennan hearing should be so interesting this afternoon, a rare opportunity for a top official to have to speak on the record. But here's another thing the president did say on CNN last fall.
In whatever operations we conduct, we are very careful about avoiding civilian casualties. And in fact, there are a whole bunch of situations where we will not engage in operations if we think that there's going to be civilian casualties involved.
So Zeke Johnson from Amnesty International, rather than unlimited war on a global battlefield, he's talking about limits if there are going to be civilian casualties involved in an anticipated or a considered drone strike, that it's a targeted, focused effort at people who are on a list of active terrorists who are trying to go in and harm Americans, hit American facilities, and so on, the president's words.
But look, again, not a single mention of human rights law. I mean, the background issue here is still, again, this quote-unquote global war legal theory. It's enshrined in the 2001 Authorization for Use of Military Force, the infamous AUMF, and it's the exact same theory behind the Obama administration's embrace of indefinite detention and unfair trials at Guantanamo.
But doesn't he imply human rights when he talks about situations in which they won't go in because of civilian casualties or limiting it to a list of active terrorists who are trying to go in and harm Americans?
We shouldn't have to read into whether or not President Obama is following human rights law. That human rights law should be front and center. That's the key issue here.
So do you both, and Omar, you can answer this first, do you both oppose drone strikes in all cases if we're talking about leaders of al-Qaeda believed to be planning terrorist attacks against Americans?
Sure, Brian. I mean, I think any scholar of international law will tell you there certainly are instances in which a state can use lethal force. You can imagine if as the analogy has been raised, if somebody's sitting with a nuclear warhead about to fire it off at the United States, I think there'd be few folks at Amnesty International or our law school or anywhere that will tell you that the U.S. doesn't have the duty to in fact, take action to stop that individual. I think the real question, and just a couple of points to add to what Zeke said about President Obama, Obama's rational legal argument for drones is, what are those limits? I mean, if we actually go through the White memo that you mentioned, he says the attack must be imminent, but he redefines imminent to mean, basically there doesn't have to be a specific attack in mind. So, you know, we're not talking about someone with a nuclear warhead ready to fire it off, but rather somebody that may have a general predisposition to want to fire a strike. The international legal standard is that to attack before an attack is that it must be instant, overwhelming, leaving no choice of means and no moment for deliberation. President Obama also in the memo talks about it must be capture must not be feasible, but they redefine feasibility to essentially mean something more akin to convenience, or there must be no risk to U.S. personnel. And of course, the scary thing about that is, sure, there may be on a list and there may be an executive administration official that makes a decision about whether or not somebody is a leader of Al-Qaeda, but that decision is subject to no review. So the administration is claiming the power far from any battlefield to kill anybody, anywhere, at any time under a global war theory. But I think just to conclude, even if we put aside this memo, remember this is only the memo for killing U.S. civilians. And there, to date, have only been a handful of U.S. civilians that have been killed. Well, while evidence suggests that there have been thousands of Pakistanis, Yemenis, and others, and what's the legal rationale for going after them? And finally, let's remember that President Obama in this memo only talks about specific strikes against high-level targets, but much recent evidence suggests that the vast majority of current strikes are actually signature strikes. Strikes a target based on profiles of behavior as opposed to targeting specific leaders. And those kind of strikes really have no backing under any interpretation, I think, of international law.
Bobby in Millbrook, you're on WNYC. Bobby, thank you for calling in.
Yes, hi. I have a few things to say quickly. All of this, all the innocent people dying, it's a terrible situation. However, the technology is going to get more sophisticated, and it's going to narrow down to more specific targets as time goes on. The other thing is that you have a situation where communities are supporting. The United States has made it clear that we are not going to allow this type of behavior in those communities. Insurgency and terrorists, the terminology gets mixed. But ultimately, these communities, the religious leaders, are supporting these insurgents, terrorists, and ultimately they're being held responsible for that support.
Thank you for your call. Omar, author of the Living Under Drones report, do you want to respond to that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think two things. Let's not be, seduced by the technology here. At the end of the day, much of the intelligence that's relied upon to fire drone strikes still comes from informants, paid folks on the ground that we rely upon for information. That's the very same information we've used to detain folks in Guantanamo, to commit attacks in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's been proven to be not reliable. I mean, for example, we know in Afghanistan that there was a drone strike that actually in one case killed somebody campaigning for Afghan parliament, a case of the wrong identity, or a drone strike that killed U.S. soldiers thinking that they were extremists. And so I think that we shouldn't be seduced by the technology. And still remember, at the end of the day, there's a human element that underneath it all that we rely upon. The strikes are only as good as the intelligence. And
sure.
The second point about the support on the ground, let's be clear here that these communities do not at all support drone strikes. And a Pew survey done of Pakistan shows that even though we give hundreds of thousands of dollars in aid to Pakistan, 74% of the population considers the United States to be an enemy, and that's increased in each of the last 3 years. And the New York Times, in fact, has written that drones have replaced Guantanamo as the recruiting tool for militants. So I think, and finally, the point that the caller raised about, we need to hold folks responsible. I mean, look, the fact that there may be a couple of individuals that harbor ill will to the United States doesn't give you a warrant to engage in collective punishment and and terrorizing entire communities.
But this is exactly what they say they're not doing. It's not harbor ill will. It's involved with organizations that are planning or known to plan specific strikes against the United States, and they're going after the individuals.
Sure, but the key question, I think, Brian, is who determines that, and is who makes those decisions, and based on what information we know from...
Who should get to make it, in your opinion, those decisions?
I mean, I think you absolutely need to have a role for the courts in this process. The United States, the argument of the Obama administration has been that, there's no role for the courts in these decisions, but that has been disclaimed by the Supreme Court in their jurisprudence about detention, where they've said there certainly is a role for the courts. For example, the Obama administration in current litigation around the killing of Anwar Awlaki has said, you know, there shouldn't be a role of courts, but we're talking about a trial that's happening after the fact.
So are you talking about like a warrant for somebody's arrest? The administration should have to go to some kind of court and get a warrant to put a suspected terrorist on a kill list?
I think the warrant's a really good example, actually, Brian, because in the case of a warrant, if there's an exigent situation, if you're a cop on the street and somebody has a gun to somebody, of course you can take action in those situations. But if somebody does want to challenge the basis under which you took that action, there is legal recourse. Similarly, Anwar Awlaki, for example, was on a kill list for over a year before he was actually killed. In those kind of circumstances, there certainly is room, the same way we need a warrant to wiretap, or we need a warrant to arrest somebody, there should be some kind of legal process in place to ensure that individual rights are protected and that there is some recourse for folks that may actually not be informed high-level targets, as the administration has claimed.
My guests are two human rights activists with their views on drone strikes as President Obama's CIA Director John Brennan goes before confirmation hearings today, Omar Shakir from Stanford and Zeke Johnson from Amnesty International, and George in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello, George.
Good morning. I take it that the two gentlemen you're speaking to have all their limbs and that their relatives haven't been horribly mutilated or burned during war. I don't think it's at all beyond the pale to kill these people without having to put our people in jeopardy. What's their answer to that?
Let me jump in there, Brian. You know, I'm a New Yorker. I was here for 9/11. I saw the towers fall with my own eyes. I, as much as anyone else, wants to see justice for those attacks and to make sure that there's never an armed attack here again. You know, we all agree with that. You know, that's not the question here. The question is the U.S. government going to follow the law and counter terrorism through the human rights framework, or is it going to break the law and ignore the human rights framework? You know, I know which scenario would make me feel safer, definitely one in which the U.S. government is conducting counterterrorism operations in compliance with international human rights law.
Right. But George is asking a specific moral calculation question, and that is, do you need to put our troops in harm's way in order morally to launch a military strike? Or could you accept the idea of these automated drones being directed, you know, from the United States or from wherever they're directed from as morally acceptable without putting American soldiers at risk?
But that's not the real issue here, right? The real issue is that for moral reasons, countries around the world put in place a framework of international human rights law, right? And that rule book, in quotes, for the use of drones exists. The U.S. government has got to follow international human rights law and, in the very narrow circumstances to which it applies, the law of armed conflict. That's the moral issue. The moral issue here is the U.S. government going to follow the law like the rest of us are required to do, or is it going to break it?
Listeners, we have on our website a drone warfare sentiment map, if you'd like to see what listeners have posted over the last few months since we've had this up, or add your own point on this graph. We asked two questions on an X and Y axis. How concerned are you that the use of drones will hurt our image abroad? And how effective do you think targeted drone strikes are as a military tool? If you want to go plot a point on that graph to represent your point of view, check it out at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We're almost out of time, but since this hearing is coming up this afternoon where some of these questions are going to be raised, and perhaps what we've been hearing from you two over the last 20 minutes or so is a preview of at least some of it, although I don't know that even Democratic members of the Senate are actually going to go there to some of the points that you've been made, but we'll find out. What questions, and just give me, you know, a very short list of questions, and then we're out of time. What questions would you actually like to hear John Brennan ask this afternoon? Zeke?
Sure. Well, one thing that we saw from Brennan's pre-hearing responses is he said that U.S. drone strikes are in compliance with the law. And I'd like to know how he can say that with a straight face when the Obama administration denies the applicability of international human rights law to its counterterrorism efforts. I think that's key. You know, the second point I'd like to make is that there's more that Congress should do. relevant congressional committees should immediately set up hearings with independent experts to really explore the legal ramifications for what the U.S. government is doing and make sure that no one is unlawfully killed.
And Omar, questions for John Brennan?
I would ask John Brennan a very specific question. He made a speech in 2011 where he claimed that there have been no civilian casualties in drone strikes, but we've known from two prominent books that have come out, Bob Woodward's our most recent book and Daniel Clydman's most recent book, that on day three of the Obama administration, with many high-level administration officials there, President Obama knew that a drone strike actually killed several civilians in a strike on January 23rd, 2009, and there have been several other cases in which it's been clear that there have been civilian casualties, and why John Brennan went out and said there have been no civilian casualties when a whole body of evidence suggests that he knew that strikes that took place in the previous 2.5 years under President Obama had, in fact, killed civilians. And what does it mean in the future when we know 76 countries now have drone technology? In what way does a world in which countries have the ability and the legal justification, according to this memo, to engage in killing far from the battlefield anyone that an executive administration official feels is a high level threat? What kind of world is that going to be? And is that a world in which the United States is safer? Is that a world in which we're actually going to have the kind of threat of terrorism removed? Or are we actually making things worse?
Omar Shakir is a law student involved with the International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic at Stanford Law School and co-author of a widely discussed report last year called Living Under Drones. And Zeke Johnson is director of Amnesty International's USA Security with Human Rights campaign. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll hear an argument that Mali is not a stand. Why the media misinforms us when it compares the conflict in Mali to Afghanistan or Pakistan. Stay with us.